A father sits down to write his son a letter, not about college choices or career paths, but about survival. How do you tell your child that the world sees his body as a threat before it sees his humanity? This is an abstract philosophy. This is about walking home from school, about wearing a hoodie, about reaching for your wallet during a traffic stop. The conversation every Black parent must have with their children isn't about stranger danger or looking both ways before crossing. It's about the fact that your skin makes you vulnerable in ways that can't be fixed by good grades or polite manners. Growing up means learning the rules, but what happens when the rules are designed to break you? In One Direction lie the streets, where failing to understand unspoken codes could cost you everything today. In the other direction lie the schools, where memorizing theorems and walking in single file promise escape. Except the statistics reveal that 60% of young Black men who drop out end up in jail. The choice isn't between success and failure. It's between two different paths to the same destination, losing control of your body. This is the trap. Be too soft and the streets will take you. Be too hard and the system will cage you. The margin for error doesn't exist. Churches offered comfort through faith. Schools promised salvation through compliance. The streets taught survival through violence. But none explained the connection between poverty in Baltimore and prosperity in the suburbs, between the founding fathers and the auction block, between the dream and the nightmare of redlining. Salvation arrived through reading. A grandmother taught writing as investigation, to question everything. A grandfather's library contained Black Panther newspapers that spoke in America's native language, violence. These weren't the sanitized heroes of Black History Month assemblies. Why were only Black heroes required to be nonviolent? Malcolm X offered a different model, someone who spoke plainly, who declared Black bodies sacred, who said, "Don't give up your life, preserve your life." He never lied. He made things plain. He spoke like a free man, like his body was his own. Howard University shattered narrow definitions. On the yard, Nigerian aristocrats gave dap to California girls in hijab. High yellow preachers' children debated clerics of Osar Set. Students carried bell hooks, formed ciphers, stepped in pink and green, played saxophones where Donny Hathaway once sang. They came from Panama, Barbados, places textbooks ignored, all magnificently different, yet one tribe. This countered erasure. History books had rendered Black people invisible or slavery footnotes. Here was cosmopolitan brilliance, proof the Black diaspora wasn't just part of the Western world, but in many ways was it. The search for weaponized history began. Grand books about Queen Zinga resisting Portuguese colonizers, making a chair of her advisor when denied a seat. Howard's professors dismantled romantic notions. What about Africans who practiced slavery? What did Black even mean? Timeless category or historical construction? The realization hit. Nothing was inherently holy in Black skin. Being Black wasn't about lost kingdoms. It was about being at history's bottom, human turned object, object turned pariah. This knowledge was painful but liberating. The pursuit wasn't proving Black excellence to white people, it was understanding how race itself was constructed and weaponized. The library became freedom, not the classroom with its imposed curriculum, but the open-ended pursuit of curiosity. Poetry taught economy of truth, discarding loose words until only cold steel truths remained. Not grand revolutionary talk, but small hard things. Aunts and uncles, smoke breaks after sex, girls drinking from mason jars. These details reflected the yard's spectrum better than abstract theorizing. After readings, poets argued on U Street, reinforcing a tradition of discord. The lesson crystallized. Discomfort wasn't an alarm, but a beacon. Education's point was to break all comforting myths and leave only humanity in its terribleness. Being Black didn't immunize anyone from history's logic. Then came love, falling for a girl from Chicago who would become his son's mother. At 24, they ranked as teenage parents among their class. Their son changed everything. Before him, there were questions, but nothing beyond personal skin in the game. After him, if he went down, he wouldn't go down alone. The child's name carried weight, Samori, after Samori Touré, who fought French colonizers for the right to his black body. The struggle itself has meaning, even when victory isn't guaranteed. Responsibility for a black body means answering not just for your own actions, but for every black body's worst actions. A policeman's violence gets justified through furtive movements. The instruction, make peace with chaos, but never lie about what they took. Shortly before his son's birth, PG County police pulled him over. The same force that killed Elmer Clay Newman, shot Gary Hopkins, beat Freddie McCollum half blind. They investigated themselves and returned emboldened. He survived. Prince Jones, a Howard student, did not. A plainclothes officer shot him repeatedly as he drove to his fiancée's home, claiming Prince tried to run him over. He faced no charges. Prince Jones embodied every fear. If he, the twice-as-good Christian, son of a striving doctor who'd given him Montessori education, music lessons, European ski trips, could be destroyed, who could escape? His daughter joined those abandoned by fathers, continuing a generational pattern. The officer had been tracking someone with a different build, confronted Prince with gun drawn but no badge. He was a known liar, previously demoted for false evidence. Yet he walked free because Prince wasn't killed by one officer, but by his country and all its fears. When his son was almost five, a white woman shoved the child on an escalator, barking, "Come on!" The father protested. She recoiled. A white man threatened, "I could have you arrested," which means I could take your body. He came home shaken, his greatest regret being that defending his son had endangered him. One must be without error out here, walk in single file, work quietly, make no mistakes. But humans make mistakes. The price of error is simply higher for black bodies. White people obsess over personal exoneration. To them, racist conjures tobacco-spitting oafs. Mass lynching executioners remained persons unknown. Levittown residents argued for segregation as moral, religious, and law-abiding citizens who were unprejudiced. Evildoers must believe what they're doing is good. This is the dream's foundation. Believing their possession comes from grit and honor, with only passing acknowledgement of bad old days. At the Civil War's onset, stolen black bodies were worth $4 billion, more than all American industry combined. Cotton, rendered by enslaved hands, was America's primary export. Enslaved labor built the capital. The plunder of black life is America's heirloom, its default setting. The letter concludes with honest reckoning. In Paris, he felt strange freedom, walking streets without ever-present fear. Yet old codes that shielded him in one world chained him in the next. He wishes he'd been softer with his son, that love hadn't felt like ritual. They are entering their last years together, and he carries regret about hardness learned in a hard house. He visits Prince Jones's mother, Dr. Mabel Jones, at her affluent home outside Philadelphia. Her Christmas tree still displays stockings bearing her murdered son's name. She rose from grinding poverty in Louisiana, becoming a doctor despite segregation. She gave her children luxury ski trips to Europe, a car with a huge purple bow for her son's 23rd birthday. Without pause, she adds, "And that was the Jeep he was killed in." The Mecca couldn't save Prince Jones, just as we ultimately cannot save ourselves. We are captured by America's majoritarian bandits and cannot escape alone. Perhaps we could awaken the dreamers to what their need to be white has done, but we cannot arrange our lives around this small chance. The instruction remains, struggle for memory, wisdom, warmth. Not for the dreamer's conversion, but because the struggle itself has meaning. The dream now plunders not just human bodies, but Earth itself. The dreamers must learn their dream is our collective deathbed. But you, Samori, you must struggle anyway, carrying forward the knowledge that your body is yours, that you exist, that you matter, that you have every right to be you.